Trainer Talks and Tales acknowledges the traditional owners and custodians of the land in which we're recording this podcast, the Turrbal and Yugara people of Meanjin. We pay our respects to elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Trainer Talks and Tales love having an array of guests with a variety of opinions. However, the views of the individuals do not necessarily reflect the perspectives of the host facilities.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of Trainer Talks and Tales. We hope you've been having a great week. You are joined by your co-hosts, Daisy and Tess. Hey, Daisy, how are you? You've just come back from holidays. How are you feeling?
Hi, Tess. Hi, everyone. I am feeling so refreshed. It was so nice to spend some really quality time on our favourite island, Minjeriba, or probably more commonly known as North Stradbroke Island. We go every year with our family and we rent the same house every year, which is awesome. It's the same house that we got married in a couple of years ago. And it is beautiful because it is right on the water. It's about 100 metres or so from the Rainbow Channel, which is a really deep channel out in the ocean. So they get a lot of big sharks, a lot of big fish, which means we get a ton of wildlife off the back of our jetty. So every night we have between sort of 2 to 4 different dolphins that come over. We see them fishing, catching their ferry, which is really cool. It's very strict on Stradbroke compared to Tangalooma, for example, where they can't be fed at all. And it's really cool to see that it absolutely pays off because they have all of those natural hunting instincts. And it's great to see them playing. And the big swells that we had out there too. We saw turtles, heaps of fish, wobbegons, rays, such a variety of different marine life. And then we had a really cool this year, actually, we had a pair of whistling kites nesting in our backyard, which was amazing. So we'd see them flying around, grabbing sticks and stuff to build their nest, which is really cool. Heaps of osprey, heaps of lorikeets, galahs, heaps of koalas, heaps of kangaroos. So I feel like, and I don't know if you agree, Tess, but as an international, looking into what people pursue Australia to be like, it is Stradbroke Island. And then the mainland is like a little bit different. There's not kind of kangaroos and koalas everywhere, but Stradbroke Island is really kangaroos and koalas and animals everywhere. So it's perfect. It was, really refreshing. I read 4 books, I deleted Instagram for a few days. It was, exactly what I needed. So I had a great week. How about you though? How was your week at work?
Yeah, good. Well, not as amazing as yours, but I'd have to agree. Like, that place is just incredible. And I've stayed at that house too. There's just so many animals that it's just ridiculous, really. So I can see why you had such a good time.
Yes.
I'm really good. I had a great week at work so far. And I just wanted to touch on today that yesterday I took Louis, my border collie, to Matisse, the dog trainer's dog training or introduction basically to sheep herding. So I said that I wanted to try it and I did, and it was fantastic. So obviously we had her on a couple episodes ago and she's an amazing trainer. And this was really cool because from an outsider's perspective, it was nice seeing how much Matisse could really explain what was going on. So there was a lot of stuff that obviously made sense to me, but in layman's terms, she was explaining to people, maybe when their kelpie or their border collie was in with the sheep, that the dog was looking at the sheep, and it was a great session or great way to end the session. So she'd be like, all right guys, that was great, the dog finally looked at the sheep and didn't have as much nervousness, let's end the training session on a good note. She also explained a bit of counter conditioning. So for the dogs that were nervous and were maybe watching other dog sessions and they were looking at the sheep, she said, oh, lots of praise from the sidelines and positive reinforcement and stuff. So it was great to just see she had so much going on, all these working dogs and different trainers and different situations. And yet she was still explaining to people what was going on and how they could help their dogs in the training process. So it was awesome. It was a lot of fun. Louis was all right. He was a bit intense, but classic border collie. He was a bit like a bull in a china shop, just like splitting the sheep kind of thing. He's exhausted today. But my kelpie niece was incredible. By her third session, she was just doing so well. So she was the star pupil.
That's so cool. I'm glad that you went and you enjoyed it as much as you were hoping to. Because, yeah, like you said, the episode with Matisse was amazing and we've had some really good feedback on that. So it's great that you were able to take Louie along. And I think it's really valuable that she kind of explains everything as you go along, especially for people that, you know, that's quite new to them or not really sure what it entails. It's great to have an understanding whilst the dog's participating in it.
Yeah, she did really well and she was so correct. It's so enriching and so exhausting for them. Louis has just been like a sack of potatoes since. He hasn't even opened his eyes. I mean, he was only in there like for three sessions of like 10 minutes at a time. So it wasn't even that much running, but it must just be so stimulating and exhausting to have that kind of good run. And yeah, so he's been buggered. So it's been good for me. I haven't had to walk him today because he can't even get up.
I think sometimes you forget like how important that mental stimulation is and how tiring it can be for animals. Like I'm even thinking with you saying that, like I said, with the jetty that we have at that house, my retriever Miley, she would lie on the jetty and watch these dolphins for like over an hour. We would leave and be having dinner and she would still be down at the jetty and she would be absolutely knackered just from watching these dolphins fish. It was so cool to see her sea dog friends playing.
So yeah, so engaging and so stimulating for them. So yeah, it was awesome. So I highly recommend Fit Dog Farm if you live in Brisbane and you got a Kelpie or a Border Collie who wants to experiment with that. So do definitely recommend. But let's chat about this episode. We have a great guest for us today. It's Bianca, and she has an amazing experience. Like she has had so much experience in the zookeeping industry and she was a wonder to talk to. So should we get into this episode, Daisy?
Yes, I'm excited. Let's do it.
Well, Bianca, thank you so much for joining us. We are so excited to chat to you today. We have some great questions for you and we can't wait to get into it. But before we do, let's start off with our fast five. Are you cool if we jump straight into that?
Oh, yes. Thank you so much for having me. Let's get started.
All right. Number one, watermelon or rock melon?
Watermelon.
Favorite animal?
Oh, goodness. I did not expect this one. Today it was a seal.
Nice. Queensland or Victoria?
Oh, Queensland.
Summer or winter?
Summer.
And this one's a bit tricky. Favorite movie?
Oh, that is tricky. Jurassic Park. Got it. That one came up.
That is the best answer ever. Jurassic Park is my favorite film as well. So I'm so glad that you said that. Well, Bianca, like Tess said, we're so excited to chat to you. You are currently one of the animal training coordinators at Melbourne Zoo, which is awesome. We would absolutely love to chat to you a little bit about kind of what that role entails and what a day in the life of you kind of looks like at Melbourne Zoo.
Sure. Yeah, no worries. I may be a little bit biased, but I believe I have the best job in the zoo. In essence, my role entails overseeing the animal training programs across all the species at the zoo and coaching the staff in the application and the science of behaviour change, which is, as we probably know, the science of how we learn and learning is training. So at Melbourne Zoo, if we count the invertebrates, we have over 3,000 animals and over 90 life sciences staff. So that's really such a large group of animals and people that I am so lucky to be able to call my team and that I work with. So I attend training sessions all throughout the day, and I also teach animal training workshops across the Zoo's Victoria properties with the other two animal training coordinators. Usually we do that twice a year. So my presence at daily training sessions can involve me being an extra set of eyes to be able to coach the session or help out by either training an animal or being one of the trainers that's needed for that session. When I coach the trainers, we'll have a quick chat before the session to go through what the goal is of the session, maybe a recap of what we worked on last session. So, for example, the trainer may have been working on timing of their condition reinforcer, like their bridge or their whistle or their clicker, or it might be the timing of their delivery of reinforcers. Now, if I haven't worked with a trainer before, I'll always check in with them to ask how they would prefer feedback, because we can provide feedback in the moment or after the session, and I ensure them that any feedback that I do provide in the moment is going to be really short. Things like, great, move a bit to the left, stand a bit more forward, because I want to ensure that they still remain focused on the animal, and it's not about having a really long conversation during their session. After the session's finished, we'll set the animal up and step away from the animal, and then we can have a bigger chat, a debrief, and go into more detail about that feedback. And I don't want my feedback to be so frequent in the session that the trainer's really not working through the session themselves or problem solving, because that's not really being a good coach in my mind. I don't want them to stand there like a robot just waiting for instructions. I'm there to help build skills in the trainer. So yeah, it's really just short feedback in the moment, and then we can talk about it some more. But my role solely doesn't just focus on training sessions. I also assist the teams with anything behaviour related. So a team may raise a behaviour concern that they're observing, like an animal spending too much doing X behaviour or not seeing Y behaviour occur. So we'll generally meet as a team first and talk about the target behaviour and talk about under what conditions that behaviour is observed, and kind of come up with a plan from there. So we describe the target behaviour in observable and measurable terms, so we can all be on the same page about what that behaviour looks like. And in a lot of cases, we'll spend some time collecting observational data of the animal. So that can range from, say, 2 to 7 days generally. And this will give us a baseline data on the target behaviour in those conditions. And then sometimes we'll run a functional assessment on that behaviour. And for anyone that is unsure what that is, if they head to Dr. Susan Friedman has a great PDF on functional assessments on the Behaviour Works website, and you can download that intervention design and be able to use that for yourself with any behaviours that you're wanting to do a functional assessment on. And then once we have baseline, we'll brainstorm some interventions that we want to try to see if changes to those conditions affect that target behaviour. Changes to the environment, things like changes to the animal's husbandry routine, changes to the way that the trainer interacts with the animal are just a few examples of some of the interventions we might make. And then we go back and we take data again. We get some more observations to see if that's had an effect in any way. So yeah, the day in the life of me can be really exciting, and it's so reinforcing for myself. I could start the morning going to a crocodile crate training session, or a rhinoceros iguana voluntary nail trim session, then a binturong recall session, a lion blood draw, a free flight parrot session, a seal training session, an elephant calf EHV behavior training session. Things like blood draws and rectal presentations are really important for those calves, a gorilla cardiac ultrasound, a snow leopard emergency recall, an echidna weigh session. Like, my day is so variable. I'm very lucky. That's why I believe I've got the best job in the zoo. So each day can be slightly different, but generally I have a standard for a good 4 to 6 weeks, because as a life sciences team, the managers, the vets and I will prioritize what behaviors and what sessions I'll attend in that block for those 4 to 6 weeks. And it'll be dependent on those current priorities across the zoo. So we might have a lot of them are medical behaviors. So we might have some upcoming vaccinations or some transportation moves, x-rays, bloods that are required. So I'll work with the teams and assist them with those goals. And yes, that's basically a day in the life of me.
Wow. And what an amazing day every day would be. Like you said, it would be so varied, and you just see so many different taxa and have so many different kinds of sessions. So I can see why you think you have the best job. Well, I'll probably give you that one. That's amazing.
Thank you.
I also really enjoyed that you said that you'll ask the trainer how they like to have their feedback delivered, because as we all know, we all have different learning styles, and in the moment you might be like, I actually cannot hear what you're saying, I'm focusing too much on this. So to like have someone say that they'd prefer it afterwards and that kind of thing, that makes sense to ask the trainer first. So I like that you said that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's really important, and that's why the feedback in the moment is really short, because we don't want to get into a conversation where they turn in their head and looking away from the animal. So it might just be things that I can see might help prompt them to be able to achieve what they need to, and then we can talk about it later. So yeah, it's quite useful.
Absolutely, makes sense. Now, that career like just sounds incredible. I mean, sorry, your role. Like, can you tell us a little bit more about what your early career looked like?
Yeah, sure can. I've been in the industry for quite some time now. I started volunteering whilst I was still in high school, and in the beginning I just really wanted to work with marine mammals from an early age, probably like so many people before me and probably so many people in the future as well. I actually started my certificate three, and back then it was referred to as a zookeeping certificate. Now I think it's certificate three in animal studies, that changes name quite a bit, whilst I was still in high school. And then my plan was to go to university to further my studies to come back into the zookeeping world. But I was actually offered a full-time contract working with seals and elephants and orangutans when I finished my year 12 exams way back in 2006. So I was very, very fortunate. And I'd planned to go to uni, but because I had full-time work, I just deferred and I continued to have full-time work. So I never actually went back to uni. And since then, it's been a blast. I've worked with such a vast array of species across different zoos and marine parks in this country. And I've spent a bit of time volunteering at zoos and marine parks, mainly in the States. But majority of my career has been spent here at Melbourne Zoo. So after spending time working with seals and sea lions and dolphins, which was always my dream, I learned that actually it wasn't just one species that I was so set on working with. It was actually more behaviour and training that I really wanted to focus my career on. And in 2015, I was awarded the George Alexander Fellowship from the International Skills Institute of Australia, which really was a huge honour. And my fellowship was on global best practice in large animal training with an emphasis on primates. And they gave me the funding to spend quite a bit of time at a number of zoos. I went to Lincoln Park Zoo, Zoo Atlanta, Shedd Aquarium, Disney's Animal Kingdom, and Natural Encounters Incorporated. And as well, I attended a number of courses and workshops, including AZA's Animal Training Applications Workshop, which is the American Association of Zoos and Aquariums. I went to Ken Ramirez's Animal Training Seminar Workshop and Steve Martin's Contemporary Animal Training Management Workshop with Susan Friedman. So I was quite lucky there, and I came away having to write this huge extensive fellowship report, which I just happened to look at it this week. It's nearly 10 years old now, and I did cringe reading some of my findings because I know so much more about the science than I did back then. And that is really one of the best things I think is about our field, that we're always continually changing and we're moving the bar to improve based on new information that's coming out. And really, we need evidence that goes with it. So we need the research, we need the studies to support that. Otherwise, really, anything goes. So I know a lot of things have been revised in my short time in industry. And so I hope from 10 years now, I cringe at what I say today, knowing that we've improved on doing that. That same year, I actually was awarded a Dunbaven Fellowship through Zoos Victoria. It's an internal fellowship, and that allowed me the opportunity to trial like a mini sample of what this role that I'm in now looks like. So with my learnings from the international fellowship, the internal fellowship, and with working with a number of colleagues at Zoos Victoria, we were able to propose a business case to support the need for these behaviour positions across all three properties. Back then we had three properties. And in 2017, the bid was successful, and I've been in the role at Melbourne Zoo ever since. So I know everyone has really different pathways, but I really do feel so very fortunate to have been able to walk the road I have thus far. I've worked with so many species and people, and it's taken me all over the world, meeting so many like-minded professionals working towards improving welfare through the science of behaviour change, and being to have a few people that I look to as mentors, and none other than Susan Friedman herself has really played, she's played such a pivotal role in not only teaching me the science, but such a great role model in all facets of my life. So that's basically been my career in a nutshell.
That is incredible. Without a doubt, you have so much experience and so many amazing opportunities, and opportunities that you've absolutely deserved from a lot of hard work by the sounds of it. And I love how you spoke about, you know, cringing back on things that you might have said 10 years ago, but we always say that we do what we do until we know better. And I think you kind of even touched on that in your one of your presentations that you did at the conference where we were lucky enough to meet you last year. So I think it's really important to be able to be really humble about that as well, and be honest that we do continue to develop and continue to develop our learning as well. And things might be very different back then, and we're just continually getting better and striving for better care and better welfare for our animals alongside that too.
Yeah, Yeah, totally agree. And it's just such an exciting space to be in. So excited to see what the future looks like for us.
Yeah, 100%. Now, I was actually really lucky. I was headed down to Melbourne a couple of weeks ago to hang out with Taylor Swift, but I also went to Melbourne Zoo to hang out.
I missed you. I'm so sorry. I didn't know until I got back to work. You were
yeah, no, it was great to come to Melbourne. I've never been to Melbourne Zoo, so it was awesome to see this facility, and it was really impressive. Like, we got to spend a fair bit of time with the elephants, so seeing the elephant training was really cool. We got to see some blood draws and some work with some of the younger elephants there, which was incredible. Is there a particular behavior or a species that you've coordinated with training that you like has been a favorite, maybe, or something that's been close to your heart?
Yeah, this is really a hard question because I could literally spend a whole hour just on this question alone. Some behaviours that come to mind are daily hand injections of insulin for a diabetic gibbon, a conscious voluntary ultrasound for a pregnant gorilla to confirm the health of the upcoming infant, voluntary unrestrained rectal ultrasounds with elephants. And like I'm talking, some of these procedures are quite invasive, where the animal has the shift doors or the gates open and they can leave at any point in the session, yet they're choosing to stay with us for these procedures. A few others, a seahorse recall, a meerkat receiving a subcutaneous injection, training parrots for free flight, giving them the ability to leave their aviary and be given the opportunity for long flights, something that nature built them to do, has really been a highlight. Voluntary crating of a large Philippines crocodile with such long duration that we struggled to get him out of the crate a lot of the time in his sessions. Trailer training for zebras to willingly enter a trailer for transport and a dolphin fluoro voluntary injection. But of course, there are so many other behaviors with other animals like shape and scent recognition. And some people may label this type of training as cognitive training. But for me, I've really struggled with that label a little bit. And I looked up the meaning of cognitive in the Webster's Dictionary, and it read knowing or apprehending by the understanding. So really, to me, I'm feeling like all training is cognitive. So I just label it shape or scent recognition. So my list is really vast. Growing, but if I'm being super, super honest with you guys, the species that has been the biggest highlight for me has definitely been humans. The people that I get to work with day in and day out, the trainers that I've been able to work with and coach, seeing them be successful with their animals with a particular behavior is definitely the most reinforcing part of my job. And it's not only when they achieve that final behavior, whether it be the day they finally get a successful blood draw or the injection, it really is the process, watching the process unfold, watching them problem solve through the road bumps and watching their skill sets improve is by far the biggest highlight for me. And it may sound cliche, but you know, when they win, I win with them. And when they haven't been successful, I question myself, have I done my best as a coach? Have I given them enough support and information, upskilling opportunities to help them be successful? And I never place blame on them when things haven't gone right. That list I mentioned, a lot of those behaviours would just not have been achievable without them. So they're definitely my career highlight thus far.
I really like that answer. And I think teaching people and being a mentor and that can lead towards their development is so reinforcing to us as well, and sometimes something that we forget when we have the pleasure of working with such an array of really cool species. You touched a little bit on some of the behaviors that you trained, like a fair few cooperative care behaviors. We touched on that in one of our other episodes with Tim, and just how incredible and impressive cooperative care kind of is with animals and how that's advanced over the last years. Is that like a type of behavior that you seem to find a favorite, or is there a particular type of behavior training that you like? Or
yes, it's definitely having animals be willing participants, having a voice in their sessions, having two-way communication with them when it comes to medical procedures is definitely a highlight. You know, when I started back in 2006, it was so common for a lot of species to be netted and darted and restrained and using more intrusive methods. And now, like, we have meerkats. Even a few years ago, if you told me we could voluntary hand inject a meerkat or get them to present their paws or, you know, do an ultrasound with them, I just wouldn't believe you, because they're just so little and easy. And, you know, like, I just can't believe it. I'm still, every day I go down, I think, oh my my goodness, look what we're achieving here. So yeah, I think cooperative care and medical behaviors definitely come a long way and a highlight.
Some of the videos that we've seen over the years at the conferences, your jaw drops with the keen interest in participation. So it's definitely something that we should all be proud of, that's for sure. Now, at my facility, we've actually just started a training advisory group. So anyone who's interested in training can come to these meetings and basically just put out there what they would like to try and start writing some training plans for their animals. And it's just been so exciting seeing people have passion and igniting that passion for training. So it's something I'm really excited to see develop. But what are some things that you factor in when writing a training plan for a new behavior? And do you have any tips for people who might not have written one before?
Yeah, it's really a great question and something that we suggest everyone starts with, writing a shaping plan or a training plan. And at Zoos Victoria, the other animal training coordinators and myself have come up with a bit of a template that we get all the trainers and keepers to use. And one of the things we focus on in that plan is asking them to describe the antecedent arrangement, so the setup the training session will take place in, what's around in their environment that's going to help them achieve this behavior. We get them to list any safety considerations for the sessions as well. So they're two things that sometimes maybe people wouldn't think of adding into their shaping plan. Maybe they just jump straight to the approximations. With the approximations, what I'm looking for from someone that's approving the plans is I'm looking for what shaping tools are the trainers going to suggest using to shape that behavior. Are they going to be using prompts? Because a lot of how we shape behavior is through the use of prompts. So prompts can be things like targets or targeting or lures. And the rule we like to use with prompts is that they're faded really quickly, so they don't become the cue or the discriminative stimulus, or SD as some people refer to it as. So I looked at the plans to see, has the trainer mentioned when and where they're going to plan on fading those prompts out? And the last thing I kind of have a keen eye for looking out for is that describing the behavior in observable terms. So rather than using labels, and we're happy to use labels, but we want to make sure that we're putting a note in that training plan. You know, one of the most common words I see is comfortable. So we want to describe what comfortable looks like for that animal, because it can be different from animal to animal, it's not just species to species, it's that individual animal to animal. And to make sure that we're all on the same page, we'll just say, you know, an example might be comfortable looks like is relaxed, is forward, eyes not pinning, no twitching of skin, you know. So we want to talk about it in observable terms, and then that way they can continue to use the word comfortable in their plan, which just means that we all on the same page about what that looks like. So they're kind of my top tips for writing a training plan.
Yeah, there's some really good tips. Yeah, and I loved actually what you spoke about the antecedents, because I'm learning from you right now, because I generally did like kind of think about those antecedents in my head, but it's not necessarily something that I always write on my shaping plan. So it's, yeah, definitely I think can be really valuable having everything, every part of that behavior written down to allow you the best chance to succeed with it too. Obviously on top of the incredible work that you're doing at Melbourne Zoo, you've spoken a little bit about working alongside Susan Freeman. So she is one of the consultants at Behaviour Works, and that's exactly what you do as well. Would you mind sharing a little bit more, I guess, about what Behaviour Works does and what your role as a consultant entails?
Of course. So Behaviour Works is a company founded by Susan Freeman, who has over 45 years in the learning and behaviour field. And Behaviour Works offers online courses in the science of behaviour change, as well as consulting opportunities. So the consulting team is really a brain trust of behaviour professionals invested in continued learning and sharing of the science of behaviour change. And as a group, we really strive for dynamic and innovative behaviour change solutions together with both our human and non-human partners. If you head to the website, you'll be able to find out more information there. But one of the most popular online telecourses that Susan teaches is How Behaviour Works, or Living and Learning with Animals. And it's an 8-week class, and it's designed to provide the foundation for a comprehensive and coherent understanding of behaviour analysis as it relates to facilitating the lives of all learners. So I definitely recommend it to anyone in the field, and you can even go back and audit the class. It runs twice a year, and I know I've audited it, and the other animal training coordinators have audited it most years, and every class I still learn new things that I've obviously missed from previous classes. So that's a bit about Behaviour Works. But from a consulting perspective, I'm just so fortunate that I not only get to work with Susan, but Dr. Christy Alligood-Rice, Amy Schills, Rick Hester, and Megan Sanders are also on the team and bring a plethora of knowledge. So our role is to spend time working with other zoological facilities, assisting with their behavioural programs and helping grow the skill sets of both the staff and the animals. It could be providing workshops or webinars or face-to-face coaching, assisting with running functional assessments, or reviewing recorded training sessions and providing feedback from them. So really each project is quite unique, tailored to the needs of each place. But yes, it's very reinforcing to be part of such a great team as well as my Melbourne Zoo team.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, obviously you would have had a lot of mentors in your amazing long career. Has there been something that has been said to you that's really stuck with you throughout your career?
Yeah, look, there's quite a couple of things that have stuck with me and all at different kind of times. And I can share some of those with you today. One of them is behaviour is a study of one. So it's really about that one individual in that one moment of time in that context. So often we can hear things, oh, well, elephants do this and gorillas do that and fish do this, but we really need to nail it down to that individual animal in that context. So that's been quite helpful to train in chaos. You know, for so long I was trying to wrap my animals up in cotton wool and, you know, have this sterile environment of no noise, turn your radios down, don't have extra people there. Well, is there a chainsaw in the background? What's going on? But the reality is the environments that these animals live in can be quite chaotic. And so I really want to make sure that I'm training in their normal environment. So it really does help build resilience, I find, in their sessions and through the behaviours. So that's another good tip that I've kind of stuck with. I think Daisy touched on it before, but I have this saying above my computer, printed out above my computer, and it says, I did then what I know how to do. Now that I know better, I do better, by Maya Angelou. And that's really something that stuck with me because, as I said, I started in 2006 and the way we trained animals is completely different to the way we train animals today. So I've seen a huge shift in what we do in that space, and that sentence just is a great reminder to me to not be so harsh on myself, and for other people to come into the office and say, oh, goodness, if I think about what we did back then, I just shake my head. So that's really, really stuck with me. Yeah, there are a couple of the things that have really stuck with me. You know, another thing is mistakes. You know, for so long I was so terrified of making a mistake or being embarrassed to make a mistake. I didn't want to admit it. I wouldn't admit it. And I would hate if someone was around watching me whilst I was training and I made a mistake. But really what I've learned is that now I love mistakes. Mistakes are just more information for us to do it better next time. So it's really part of that learning process and really not shying away for that. So I really try hard, but, you know, I'm still working in this space of making mistakes in front of people so that they can see that it's not a big deal. It's how we move forward with that information is what's important.
So cool. I think all of those things are so valuable. And yeah, like you said, that particular quote that you mentioned is definitely something that sits really strongly with me and something that's really cool to resonate on. And I really liked how you spoke about at the start as well, that we're doing this, you know, for one animal rather than the species. It's an individual. So much of one species can be so different within different individuals. Do you usually, like, how much do you consider the species though when starting a new program with an animal, for example, alongside that particular species?
Yeah, we always want to, and that's a little part of our shaping plan as well, some background relevant background information about this species, because we want to make sure that we've done our research, that we know what this species brings to the table. But we also know that just because a species may be nocturnal, you may have some individuals that do come out during the day, or ones that definitely don't come out till it's completely dark. So we want to have that information. It's super important to go in. It helps us bring more to the table. You know, it helps us without picking our reinforcers, what they might like, trialing all those things, setting up the antecedent arrangement. If I'm working with a meerkat, I know that they're They've got someone standing on guard all the time, checking the skies, looking for birds of prey. And so I'm not going to train them in probably a big open space where they might feel vulnerable. That's part of their biology. It's what nature's built them to do. So it is still super important, but it doesn't mean that I'm not going to have a bold meerkat in the group that's not looking at the sky at all. And I might have the other spectrum where I've got a meerkat that just does not stop looking at the sky. So it's super, super important. You're right, Daisy.
I also like that you just talked about mistakes and mistakes being made, because I mean, everyone says it, like, you learn from your mistakes, but you actually do. And I think it's important as mentors and trainers as well that we let people make mistakes, and that is how they learn. Like, just yesterday I had a training session and someone apologized to me afterwards, like, oh, I'm so sorry, I did not see that kangaroo and that's why the bird flipped out. And I was like, I actually did see the kangaroo, and I wanted you to, you know, like, just see that and have that moment where you recognize the bird's behavior was frightened. And so we learn from these mistakes. If I had told you first, like, you'd be like, oh yeah, no worries, and you wouldn't know to look out for kangaroos, but you have to learn that yourself. So making mistakes is a great thing that you mentioned, so I'm really glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, and that's a great example of you that you bring to the table from yesterday. It's exactly right talking about.
Bianca, for people who are currently about to start their journey or sort of in the early process of the world into training, can you share sort of any resources, sorry, that you would recommend for them?
Yeah, and I know it can be so overwhelming and daunting, I feel like, when you're first starting out, because there is just so much information out in that big wide world, especially when it comes to training. As we're learning more people are putting more information out there, so I feel you and I hear you out there that it can be, yes, very overwhelming. I always recommend grabbing a copy of Paul Chance's Learning and Behaviour book. It's a really great place to start. It's a really good foundation book of the science, because the science can be a lot. I mean, it has taken me such a long time to become more confident and fluent in a lot of these terms and principles, and I've got still so much to learn. I am not by no means an expert whatsoever. I think the third edition is the one I have, and I hear that's the best one. And you can pick it up a second-hand copy of it really, really cheap, like $5 or $10, I think, if you jump on Google and have a look. So definitely recommend grabbing that book. And then you know, there are so many great websites out there. Clicker Training, Ken Ramirez's work. He's such an awesome trainer, and they have conferences every year that are so, so good to go to. It is very focused on the dog training world, but as we know, behavior is behavior, and the way we train is the same principles across all species. And it's just so fascinating when you tell people that it's the same. They just don't believe you. They just think, what do you mean? You train the butterfly the same way you train the elephant? Well, of course, we have different reinforcers, and of course, there are, you know, slightly different antecedent arrangements and what have you, but the principles that we use are the same across all species. You know, if I talked about the laws of gravity, no one argues with me about those, but when it comes to the laws of learning, everyone seems to have an opinion. So yeah, Ken Ramirez, I know Steve Martin and Natural Encounters, obviously Behavior Works. There are so many great courses out there. This podcast, you know, there's so many podcasts, and yeah, there's a plethora, but feel free if you ever get stuck or you're unsure, you're reading something and it's contradicting something else, always happy to help out. If someone wants to reach out and send me an email, I'm happy to provide my advice and which path to go down to, but definitely starting with those books is a must.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some plug. Yeah, always love a TT&T plug. But yeah, I was just going to say we constantly, like, and I think it's really valuable if you're already working in an environment where training is present to have those discussions as well. Like at work, we constantly have not heated, but like really interesting training chats when people might slightly disagree or people want to understand in a slightly different way. And it's such valuable conversations. You're constantly getting other people's opinions and seeing different sides of it. So I think just by starting those conversations, if you're not sure, like you mentioned, is a really great start as well.
Yeah, those conversations can be so healthy, I would say.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
They're so important to help with culture of a team as well. Like having a culture where you and your team members are open and willing to have those conversations, and you know, there's no egos involved or people wanting to slam their opinion down. It's super important, and it goes to show you that culture of that team. So definitely have those conversations. Yes, I agree. They're really, really helpful.
Absolutely. Now, we mentioned before what maybe a mentor has said to you that's really stuck with you throughout your career, but is there some training advice that you personally have that you would love to share with our training community?
Yeah, I guess I would love to share a little bit, a condensed version of the story I shared at the conference last year where I met you lovely ladies. I got some great feedback from it. Not only did I get some great feedback from it, but the feedback that I got, I label it as great, but it was things like, oh, you've really helped me. I've experienced that as well. I'm currently going through that. So I think if I just tell you a little bit about that, I'm hoping that sharing that insight will help our community. But basically, when I started in an environment where positive punishment and negative punishment and negative reinforcement were heavily relied on. We still use positive reinforcement, but it was in the days where I was told, you know, we had to be dominant over animals, assert our dominance. When we gave a cue, the animal had to do what we told it to do because we were the boss, and we had to get him to do it when we said, not at any other time. If they're offering behaviors and we hadn't cued it, to not reinforce it. So that was kind of the era that I grew up in. I grew up thinking I was using intermittent reinforcement, which meant I would cue behaviors, and I wouldn't reinforce everyone, yet I'd blow my whistle or click my clicker or say the word good, which now I know more about the science is actually continuous reinforcement that I was using, because I was clicking and bridging. I just wasn't backing up those conditioned reinforcers with food, so all I was doing was weakening those conditioned reinforcers, or those secondary reinforcers, which meant I had animals stop responding to the whistle or the clicker, or they'd keep offering behavior, or I'd give a cue and they'd give me incorrect responses. So I saw a lot of that. And then I saw a lot of what I would label frustration and aggression in sessions from animals. And that looked different depending on what species I was working with, whether it was, you know, animals banging on the mesh or trying to grab ankles or whatever. It looked very different depending on the species, and I would always just place blame on the animal. I would be like, that animal, you know, is not a good boy today, or is having a bad day, or he knows he should be shifting, he knows how to shift, she knows what she should be doing, she's just playing games with me. So that's the kind of terminology not only did I throw around, but I started teaching people this stuff as well. And it really wasn't until 2013 when I started to get introduced. I went to a Steve Martin workshop at Dreamworld, and he was talking about backing up the conditioned reinforcer every single time and not taking responsibility for your animal's behavior. And I thought, who is this Looney Tune American? What is he talking about? I have never trained like that, and I still get behavior. So I basically went away thinking, oh, what a waste of money that was. I didn't learn anything. I know more than this guy. So I ignored his advice. I waited a whole nother year, and then I went to some more workshops. Susan Friedman came out and she talked to us about antecedents and consequences. And I just thought, oh, what are those terms? I have never heard those before. These Americans, I don't know what they're smoking over there, but I am not on the same page again. So I ignored her advice as well. And my ego was just so big, I have to say. You know, I'd come from the marine mammal world. I was just so cool. And then in 2015, when I got that fellowship that I talked about before, Ken Ramirez was by far just like this idol of mine. I used to put him on this pedestal. Marine mammal trainers would know what I'm talking about. And then I went to his workshop, and all of a sudden he started talking about the same thing Susan and Steve Martin had talked about. And I just thought, oh, my goodness, have I missed something? Yeah, and I'd missed the point where my ego had gotten in the way of me actually retaining the information or being willing and open to listening and trying some of these things. And then I went to all the other workshops and courses, and of course they were all talking the same language and all on the same page, and I just thought, oh my goodness. So I went back to work, and I didn't tell anyone because I didn't want to admit that whole thing about mistakes. I didn't want to admit anything. I trialed it out with this one gorilla, and all of a sudden Skrilla was like learning new behaviors at a rate that I had not seen before. She was showing no frustration and aggression anymore in sessions. She was getting cues correct like 99% of the time. And everyone turned to me and said, she was a new gorilla that had come to us from Taronga, and they had said, wow, why did Bianca get assigned the smart gorilla. It's just not fair. She got the good one. And of course, I wasn't going to admit, oh my goodness, I'm trying all these new techniques that I had learned about. And eventually, after a few months, I admitted to the team, this is what I'm doing, this is what I've learned. And then we kind of started to roll it out with some more species. And then we got Braves, the team, and we went and told the SEAL team, oh, hey guys, we're doing this. Why don't you come over and have a look? And they came over and had a look. And of course, they just shut it down. They're like, fuck, what are you guys doing? Nah, we're good. We're all right. And slowly, slowly, it was this evolution. And we are where we are today, where I don't place blame on the animal. I have super high rates of reinforcement. I use a 1-to-1 ratio. I don't train with like a monologue style where it was just like, you must do this now because I told you to. It's a dialogue. So I watch their behavior and I change what I do based off their behavior. I look for those little tell signs. You know, if we're getting, if we're working on blood for an elephant from the back of its ear, if it starts twitching that ear, we take our hands off and we stop and we tell them, no worries, you have a voice. You have a voice through your behavior. You're telling us right now you're not comfortable with that. We'll change what we're doing. We'll up our rate of reinforcement. We'll change our reinforcers. And we'll turn that no that you're telling us, we'll acknowledge that no, and then we'll turn that no into a yes, and then we'll move forward from them. So I guess my advice is, you know, there are so many egos out there, and I was definitely one of those people that had a huge one. So just be try to be open-minded to new information that comes out at you, and you'll be able to pick up when you're around certain people, the words that they say, if it's all very I, me, this is how you do it. You know, you'll start to think, huh, that's interesting use of words. I'm not too sure about that. So I guess that's my advice to the community. Be open, and we're all continually learning and growing together. So, yeah.
I love that. And thank you for being kind of a little bit vulnerable almost and saying all of that stuff, because you're definitely reflecting on the fact that you're a better trainer now from being open-minded. And I really like how you spoke about the dominance and the assertion at the start, because in one of my first facilities I worked at, all I ever wanted to do at the time was to work with elephants. And I was told pretty quickly that you are not an authoritative person. You're not a dominant person. So you should cancel that out. And it's kind of stuck with me, and I kind of took that and was like, yeah, absolutely. Like, that's never something I can do. And now, since my learning and understanding of behavior and the science behind it, I'm like, absolutely, it does not matter what kind of person I am, as long as I understand the science and I understand the behavior, then I can, you know, apply that to any species that I want to achieve to work with.
Oh, you are 100% correct. You know, that when I said I started with elephants, we were in free contact. It was it was drilled into me, you have to do this because this is your safety, and if you don't do it, you're not cut out to be an elephant trainer. And so, you know, they start you off on the seals. And they try to get you to use some of these techniques first. And then if you made it, then you got to do elephants. And so, yeah, I'm just so happy that we're past that now, and we're onto bigger and better things. And yeah, it just goes back to that saying, I did then what I knew how to do, and that's all I knew how to do. So that's what I did. It's just so cool to watch the not just the organization, the whole community, training community, move in a different direction. And so excited to listen to this podcast in 10 years time to think, oh my god, what was I talking about back then?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, what a cool community it is too. Like, how lucky are we to be a part of that? Bianca, we do have a couple of questions from our listeners. So I was going to dive straight into question number one, because you did kind of touch a little bit earlier on the fact that you're a part of the free flight for the parrots at Melbourne Zoo. What was the biggest training hurdle that you've come across when training parrots?
I have two things that come to mind straight away, because most of my time working with parrots have been in a free flight situation. One of the things is, we started free flying parrots nearly 5 years ago now, and we did it as part of a project that we were doing at the time. And I remember we went around, myself and another trainer went to a few different facilities around Australia to get more information, to learn, because that's what, you know, this community is all about, networking and learning from each other. And we told them what we were trying to do. We had 8 parrots, we were trying to free fly them, and they were telling us about their journeys on them getting their birds ready for free flight. And they said, oh, when are you hoping to, get this project up and running? And we were like, oh, in about 10 weeks. And they just like nearly fell off their chairs. They were like, 10 weeks? What are you talking about? This show took us a year or this. Have you ever done this before? And we were like, oh, no, we're getting a little bit of help, but we've never done this before. And so we went away thinking, oh my goodness, are we biting off a bit more than we can chew? So one of the biggest training hurdles was to get 8 parrots ready for free flight in 9 weeks. After we went on that week excursion around, that chewed into one of our weeks, so we were down to 9. That was definitely a hurdle, and one of the ways we overcome it, I definitely could not have done it without the team involved, was really moving at the animal's pace. And so rather than having these expectations in our mind that we have to stay on this approximation for 2 weeks or 1 week or however many sessions, it was really looking at the animal's behavior, looking at when we didn't see hesitation from the animal. That was our cue to move on to the next approximation. And if we went on to the next approximation and they showed us hesitation, it was no worries at all. We weren't going to, ruin the training program or the plan or that behavior. It was just more information for us to regress back to that previous approximation. And a lot of the times the birds were so ready before we even thought they were. And they were telling us, if you took a bird to a new space, an indoor space, and you were like, oh, I don't know if I should get it out of the crate. Will it recreate? This, you take the bird out and you go, okay, I'll do one flight, one A to B flight, and then I'll try and recreate it. And this bird's like leaning its chest all the way towards the crate. It's like, yeah, put me in, I'm ready. So that's what I'm kind of talking about. So that's definitely was one of the biggest training hurdles. And another one that I can think of is some of the parrots that I've worked with have come to us from different facilities and sometimes from private owners and have varying different previous learning histories. And so that's really been a big challenge as well, not knowing a lot about their history and coming in, working with a young parrot who has been basically raised around people, played with a lot of toys that are plastic or metal or what have you. And so putting him into a free flight aviary, of course he's attracted to the plastic and the metal and the prams and the people's keys and the bags and the toys. And so yes, that's been another training hurdle that I've faced with parrots, is that depending on their learning history, when we start working with them, that'll really depend on what kind of shaping plan we take with that individual and what environment we put them in. So there are a couple of my training hurdles with parrots.
Yeah, they're great answers. I'm always so impressed with parrot training. I obviously haven't had a lot of experience with it, and the difference between parrots and raptors is phenomenal. So I love hearing anything about that. So that's very interesting. Good answer for sure. Now we have one more question, and I know you did touch on a lot of amazing behaviors that you did train, but the question was, what has been your very favorite behavior to train, and what were the first steps to training that behavior?
Yes, and you probably might not like this answer, but it was just way too hard to pick one, I think. There's way too many on the list, but I can think of two things. One is being part of those firsts. We're very lucky that we've had these positions at the zoo for quite some time now, and we for decades and decades they've always trained elephants, they've always trained seals, they've trained gorillas. So a lot of these well-known species had been training for quite some times, but some of these other species hadn't really had daily training sessions at all, really. And so we're seeing a lot of firsts happen that we hadn't heard of, or definitely overseas some zoos and parks have done before. But doing an awake conscious gorilla cardiac ultrasound with our silverback gorilla, cardiac diseases is very dominant in male gorillas. It's very common. And doing that for a first in this region, it was like, oh my goodness, this is so cool to be a part of. I mean, Zoo Atlanta's been doing it for 20 plus years, but for us to do it, it was so cool. So being a part of those firsts, first time we got a voluntary blood draw from a cat, the first time we, ultrasounded a pregnant meerkat, the first time we, all these firsts have been so cool to be a part of. And another thing that comes to mind is watching these elephants. I started with these elephants. Our herd has grown now, but we do have some of the females. I was here, we moved some elephants over from Thailand back in 2006, and I was on the team when they first arrived. And watching them when we first started changing the way we train back in 2017, 2018, watching those individuals go through that process is really been a favourite of mine to be a part of, because we had elephants who had a history of a lot of positive punishment, a lot of pressure and release training, so negative reinforcement. And some individuals, you know, I'll give you two examples of these two individuals, these two females. One female was labelled as super aggressive. She was the last elephant you got to learn to train. And, you know, you had to be really careful. She was such a dangerous elephant, even though we were in protective contact by this stage. As soon as we started changing the ways, we had a really high rate of reinforcement. We started giving her a voice in the sessions. We allowed her to say, no, thank you. We didn't use timeouts. We were using a one-to-one ratio. We started to see a huge shift in her behavior. And no joke, it happened with like within a week or two. She started, stopped showing us these behaviors of aggression that we had previously seen. And all of a sudden, it was just like watching this new elephant. And so it was fascinating to be a part of that process. And we did the same process with every elephant at the exact same time. And then we had another female, and this is this whole study of one as well, who came in with the same learning history, but took months and months to learn it was okay to get something wrong, to make a mistake in her training. You know, you'd give her a cue, you'd ask for her left foot to come up, and she'd offer you her right foot. And within a few seconds, she would start squeaking really loud, vocalizing, her ears would start flapping really quickly. She'd move her head, like cringe her head back a little bit, and she'd quickly swap her foot. She knew that she hadn't gotten the correct criteria for that cue that we had given. And you could see it by her behavior. She, well, I'll say it looked to me like she was nervous of that consequence that was going to follow for giving us the wrong foot. So for her, it took her months to understand that there was not going to be any punishment that followed her giving us the wrong behavior, that it was going to be okay, and that we were going to redirect and use other tools on our training belt to help her along the way. And so it was fascinating to be a part of that. And I guess that's been one of my favorite behaviors to watch, I guess, reshape and train. And the first steps to doing that was no consequence that followed. That was punishment. You know, if she picked up her wrong foot, no worries at all. Wait a second or two and ask for another behavior. You know, give her the opportunity to earn reinforces in another way and re-cue it. But when we re-cue it, we were going to change what we did. She obviously didn't get that cue correct because it was something that was going on. Whether she wasn't ready to receive that information, was she distracted in the barn by something that was going on? Was it our body positioning? Did we have to help her? You know, could we move 4 steps to the left? Could we place our target stick in a different location? So really watching that process unfold, and that's kind of the first steps on how we helped her through that, those months of learning. So yeah,
I think we've learned from you, Bianca, that you can't have favorites, because everything is so exciting. You've been part of so many different things, and it's so cool to hear that about the elephants. Like, it seems like they tend to have a bit of a history overseas with using sort of positive punishment and other methods, as we heard from Tim with his elephants a couple of weeks ago in our podcast as well. So it's great to hear that they're in such good care, and that whole mentality around that old school training has changed, and you're seeing such positive results from it too.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. You said yourself, seeing the elephant team a few weeks ago, they're really such a great team, and they're amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Bianca, I honestly think that we could probably sit here all day and talk for hours, but unfortunately we do have to wrap it up. Tess and I are so incredibly grateful for your time and sharing all your knowledge, your expertise. It's so clear that you're absolutely so passionate about animal training, and the team at Melbourne are obviously extremely lucky to have you. So we're so grateful that you're able to share everything to our listeners, and I'm sure that they're going to get a lot out of it as well.
Well, thank you, and thank you, Tess. It's been a pleasure coming along and sharing some stories, and, you know, just a shout out to you guys for being able to have this platform to spread this and give this information to our community. It's so needed, and you guys are doing some great work.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's all inspired by seeing you and seeing so many others at those great conferences. So yeah, right. Yeah, back after.
Thanks, Bianca. Oh, Tess, I really enjoyed that episode. It was so nice to chat to Bianca again after we had the pleasure of meeting her at the conference last year back on the Gold Coast. So it was really interesting hearing all about her experience. She's got so much training knowledge, and it's I really hope actually that a lot of people take a lot from that episode and find it pretty inspiring too. And a big shout out obviously to Bianca for coming on and Suze Victoria for making it really nice and easy to be able to chat to her and hear all about her stories and her experience.
Yeah, it was a great episode. I loved it too.
Yes, definitely. Well, that is us done for another week, but don't you worry, we do have another really cool episode coming to you next week. But until then, we will chat to you soon.
Have a good week. Bye.